This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome to Hometown Heroes. Happy Independence Day. Thanks for listening on this 4th of July afternoon. Hope you're staying cool here in the Valley or wherever you're tuning in our signal today on News Talk 580 KMJ or on the internet at kmjnow.com. Tell me if you've heard this before. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. That was part of the unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America 233 years ago today in Philadelphia. Did you know that the Declaration of Independence was stowed away at Fort Knox during World War II? That's true. It was there along with the English crown jewels, the Magna Carta, and also the gold reserves of several countries of occupied Europe. Today, my guest on Hometown Heroes remembers that era well. He remembers a good deal, more than 90 years of American history, because he just turned 93 last month. And you talk about occupied countries in Europe, he flew over a lot of them in his B-17, flew deep penetration missions into Germany, and lives to tell about it. Bill Cahow, our guest today. Bill, I want to start out. Now, I understand you are a Fresno native, and here you are still in your hometown 93 years later. I like to start out with veterans, with what they remember about December 7th, 1941. And I've heard a lot of different stories from guys who were in Long Beach and went out to the shore with a rifle that night looking for the Japanese to come aboard, to kids who heard it at right after church that morning, all kinds of different stories. I don't think I've heard a story quite like yours about December 7th. You were exercising your love of alpine sporting events that Sunday in 1941, weren't you?
Right. I was skiing up at
Was that Badger Pass?
No, not Badger Pass. Up at I can't even think of the name of the place.
Past Huntington Lake, huh?
Yeah, past Huntington, Kaiser Peak.
Kaiser, all right. Just had the bike race up there last weekend.
Yeah. It was early, well, December 7th, so it was early in the season before Badger opened. I was a ski instructor up at Badger Pass and just waiting to get called up. And what made it unusual, I was skiing with one of my Japanese buddies.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Yasi Teramoto. Yasi and I took off and we went skiing up at Kaiser Peak.
And so clearly, you had no idea what was happening in Honolulu when you're at the top of Kaiser Peak and shredding the fresh powder up there.
No, we didn't have we didn't have the radio on. In fact, I don't think we had a radio in that old clunker of mine. And we never knew what was happening until we got down to Huntington Lake, and they had a bunch of roughnecks with shotguns and rifles, and they held us up there. And
they were just standing in the road,
stopping every car. And, of course, when I had a Japanese boy in there, they were thrilled. I had to vouch for him, and there was one fellow that was pretty sharp. So he was a sheriff, and he let me talk them into vouching for Yasi and taking him home.
Well, I'm sure he was glad that you were with him at that point, because there were a lot of crazy things that happened right about that time and soon thereafter. Did you realize there and then, and you're a little older than a lot of the veterans that I talked to, you're already, 25 years old at this point.
Yeah.
Did you realize that you were probably going to be involved in the service at some point in the near future?
Yes, I'd already signed up for the ski patrol.
Mm-hmm.
And I was ready to go, signed up, just waiting for it to be called up. And December 7th came along. And one of my, then shortly afterwards, well, Badger Pass opened, and one of the fellows that in my class was a major out at Hammer Field, and he talked me into signing up with the Air Force. I'd already had $300, which was stupid of me anyway. I'd been flying for 5 or 6 years before the war came on.
So the Air Corps was a good fit for you,
yes,
and you knew you'd get some time in the cockpit. A lot of guys, when I talked to them, though, when they decided to be pilots in the military in this time in American history, they wanted to fly those fighters. They saw a P-47. They thought that looked like fun. Or they heard about General Chenault and the Flying Tigers and his P-40s, and they said, let's fly something maneuverable. And then the P-38 comes along, and that looks like fun. Did you want to get into bombers, or were you thinking fighters too? An honest man.
I fought that tooth and toenail. I wanted to be a fighter.
Uh-huh.
But I guess my age, they figured I was more responsible and could better serve the country as a bomber pilot.
Well, those fighter pilots, a lot of the time, at least as far as that plane is concerned, they're responsible for one life. But when you're a B-17 pilot, you've got your whole crew to worry about.
That's right.
How long was it before that you ended up in a flying fortress and got to know that that big beast of a plane?
I went through primary, advanced, and then I was sent to be B-17 primary, and that was at Boise, Idaho.
Mm-hmm. That once you actually got in the B-17 and you got to know the crew that you had with you, did you come to take a liking to it? It certainly was a pretty durable aircraft.
Well, it was a very good aircraft. It was the best of its time by far.
So you end up...
I flew B-24s too, so I started out in B-24s and then transferred to B-24s. I got 12 hours of B-24s and went into B-17s.
Well, you've ended up flying a lot of airplanes. I remember a very good piece that my friend Bill McEwen wrote about you and your wife Bonnie in the Fresno Bee about 2 years ago. And he says in there that you eventually did get to fly a P-51. So you had that taste of being a fighter pilot after all.
Well, that was after I came back to the United States and I was an instructor pilot in B-29s.
Mm-hmm.
And my roommate was a squadron commander of the P-51s, and he checked me out in the 51. Well, that was a real thrill.
That's like
that
going
was
from
a real thrill.
That's like going from a moped to a Ferrari, huh?
Yeah, I wanted to go to war.
Well, we might talk some more about that later, but up next, we're going to talk about the missions that Bill flew with the 533rd Bomb Squadron of the 381st Bomb Group in Europe, part of the 8th Air Force. And just to kind of put it in perspective for you, some statistics on the 8th Air Force. There were more than 350,000 men serving in the 8th Air Force. Out of that number, 28,000 ended up becoming prisoners of war during World War II. 26,000 were killed. Put that in perspective. Just from the 8th Air Force alone, 26,000 were killed during World War II. That's more than six times the number that have been killed in the current war in Iraq, if that puts it in any kind of perspective for you. But Bill Cahow is one of the survivors, and he's here to tell that story for us today. And he had some pretty close calls that he's going to share with us. So when we come back, we'll get right into that. Bill Cahow, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
The Wild Blue Yonder. That's what Bill Cahill signed up for nearly 70 years ago now. I guess I'm going to have to start saying as we get further and further away from the history that is World War II. That now Air Force theme composed, well, performed there, I should say, by the Sounds of Freedom Band, local band that you hear quite frequently on this program. And you can see some of their performance tonight, the 4th of July special on Veterans Television, channels 95, 96, 98 on Comcast, if you're in Fresno or more than 40 other cities around the valley that have that new channel. A lot of entertainers performing for troops tonight at 8 o'clock on channels 95, 96, 98. You know where this is on the dial. It's KMJ 580 AM throughout the state of California and online at kmjnow.com. So now let me continue with Bill Cahill, who was a B-17 pilot during the war, serving in the 8th Air Force, part of the 381st Bomb Group, the 533rd Bomb Squadron, on a flying fortress. That's a B-17. And Bill, at that time, now you got over there to Europe, to England, is where your bomb squad, your group was stationed, pretty early on, before the Americans had really established air supremacy. So I imagine that you saw quite a few German fighters and encountered quite a bit of flak. What went through your mind when you woke up and you saw this is your target today, this is where the mission is going, and you have to have an idea of what kind of what you're going to run up against from the other side?
You mean in briefing?
Yeah, when you get briefing, and I know that you had to pass on some of this to other guys as well, to other pilots. It seems to me that that would be a little daunting when you look at an area on the map that you know is heavily fortified and know that you're going to run into a lot of opposition.
Well, after a few missions, you could tell as soon as the target would be blanked out and the operations officer would come up and they'd pull the curtains back and there would be a red string, showing from your base to the target,
mm-hmm.
and also back, because you'd come back a different way many times. And as soon as that, if it was a tough target, like Schweinfurt or Anklam or some of the real, or Bremen, some of the real tough targets, well, there would always be a groan, a big groan go up.
Well, because you were aware.
You were aware of.
And Schweinfurt, I guess, is a good example because
a big groan went up.
You got in on the second real offensive against that city.
Yes.
And the first one, how many American planes? About 60 American planes have been shot down?
30 planes were shot down in the first Schweinfurt raid. 60 planes were shot down, but half of them went to Schweinfurt and half of the planes went to Regensburg. They split the division up.
So you...
And the second mission, all of them went to Schweinfurt, and 60 of them were shot down, and all of them were shot down on the Schweinfurt mission.
And that's one of those missions. You're coming from England.
Yeah.
And you have a long way to go to get to the target. You're flying over hundreds and hundreds of miles of German territory just to get to the target. Then you have to drop your bombs and then turn around and get back. That's a lot of time to be shot at and a lot of opportunity to get shot down.
Well, that's what made it so tough. So many things entered into that made it rougher because due to the weather, they didn't take off on time. It took off. So the Germans were alerted, and so they pulled fighter planes from deep into Germany, and so they just constantly rotated their attacks all the way in, all the way out.
Now, sometimes you would have escorts, and at this time, mostly P-47s, I guess, before the P-51s really came
P-47s.
In too much. But those escorts didn't always take you all the way to the target, did they?
Oh, heavens no. They wouldn't go that far. I saw our escorts start breaking away and turning back towards England. I could still look back there and see the English Channel. So you were only about maybe 40, 50 miles inland in the France at that time when they broke off. And the Germans didn't attack us at all. They just swarmed just ahead of the fighters and our planes coming in. And
but then, you saw German fighters coming your way.
Oh, yeah, we saw them swarming.
Like we're talking 100, 200 airplanes.
Oh, yeah.
From the other side. Yeah. And you, but you, as part of a B-17 formation, there you can't try to avoid these fighters. You have stay exactly on course and in formation.
That's right.
And if there's flak coming up, there's nothing you can do about it, right?
You just go through it. Actually, the flak was more, when you got flak, well, the Germans would break away. So that was a blessing on that mission.
You'd rather have flak than
some
ME-109s coming at you. Did that, and now this particular mission you're talking about, that second major mission to Schweinfurt, some people have referred to that as Black Thursday because of the devastation that ensued.
Yeah.
Did that seem like one of the longest missions that you had? Did it seem like it was never going to end?
Yeah, it did. Well, it was so intense, and no, it didn't seem like the longest mission. There were breaks, you know, in between where there would be breaks, but very, very few. It's almost a constant swarm of attacks.
And when you're the pilot, and you have the rest of the crew depending on you, and they're looking to you to stay calm and to demonstrate the attitude that you need and the focus, where does that come from? How do you stay cool and calm and not panic when you see what sounds like an overwhelming situation to me?
I don't think I did.
You weren't so calm. Huh?
I was sweating. There was sweat in various parts of my body.
I think we can all imagine and certainly understand why that was happening. Can you describe for our listeners how the events of that day unfolded, what you experienced? I know eventually some of that shrapnel hit your plane, which was probably not uncommon.
Yeah, we had maybe 40, 50 holes in the plane, you know. And just by luck, nobody was hit. We came through without a scratch. I mean, as far as personnel was concerned.
Because you've got guys all over this plane.
All over the plane.
And a lot of times they're shooting from below you. They can come right up through your seat and get you. Can come right through the side and get you.
It missed everybody.
And how about the engines?
It missed the engines too. On Schweinfurt, I didn't lose an engine. So, there are times when I did lose engines. You know,
well, we're going to have
different missions.
We're going to have to talk about that too. That Schweinfurt mission, when you came back, when you realized how many times your plane had been hit, but that none of you had been hit, that none of your engines had been lost, you heard about how many other casualties there were. When you get home from a mission like that, what do you do? Do you say a little prayer and say, "Thank you, Lord, that I'm here for another day"?
Sure do.
Do they have a bottle of whiskey waiting for you? How does that work?
Well, the officers' club was open. Of course, we went right. I don't think we did. I think we were just beat by the end of that mission.
That sounds just absolutely exhausting.
They took us into at a briefing, and it was so somber. You know, so many of them had been shot down. It's such a terrible mission that I don't think we went to the club at all.
Well, I imagine, too. I mean, it's not just hearing that this number of people were killed and this number of planes were shot down. I'm sure there are a lot of days where you got the news that someone you knew pretty well was gone and not coming back. Is that something that you got used to after a while, or is that something that you never get used to?
No, I never got used to. At least I never did.
How often did you think, well, today might be my turn? Maybe I'm the guy who's not coming home today.
I tried to have a positive attitude. I had a roommate that had a very negative attitude, and I think that actually caused his demise.
Almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
It was. He kept, he just knew he wasn't going to make it, and he didn't.
What kept you believing that you were going to make it?
I'd always been lucky.
Uh-huh.
I've been lucky at athletics. I've been lucky in almost everything that I did.
And I can tell that hasn't changed too much here in 2009 at age 93. We're going to talk more about some of those missions. He talked about missions where he did lose engines, missions where he had to get creative as he came down out of the sky. And maybe one of the biggest surprises, what Bill will tell you, is the closest he came to not coming back actually was a flight where he didn't have any opposition. He'll explain that for us. We're about halfway through Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ. So many of you recognize that one. That is String of Pearls by the late, great Glenn Miller and his orchestra, as requested by Bonnie, who is Bill Cahow's wife of 63 years. They met after the war, which means she never would have met Bill if he didn't come home from all those missions in Germany. Their two children and a grandchild would have never been here if somebody wasn't looking out for Bill and brought him back to his native Fresno, by way of a few other places. And he actually met Bonnie over in Tampa, Florida. But we're going to talk about Europe during World War II and some more of those missions, Bill, in your B-17. Well, I guess multiple B-17s. How many different B-17s did you fly, or did you actually lose count after you got to 25 missions?
You mean in combat?
Right.
I think a seven.
Did you ever get to name any of them?
Yeah, Swoosh, and that's...
Swoosh.
Swoosh.
Uh-huh. Now, that doesn't sound like it would have any crazy ornate nose art on it. It went swoosh.
It went swoosh. Fortunately, I wasn't flying it. Somebody else was swooshing it.
Uh-huh. Did you ever think one plane was better than another, or did
oh,
you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There were some that you really wanted to have?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
They were different. Every plane I flew there would have some quirk, you know.
And I guess you had to know those quirks pretty well, because not knowing them could cost you your life.
Yeah, you feel them out.
Now, you mentioned before that there were plenty of times, or times that you remember, where you lost engines in the sky. Now, I imagine if you lose an engine on the way back from a bombing run, it's maybe not as troublesome as losing it on the way to a bombing run, but I have a feeling you might have experienced both of those scenarios along the way.
Yes, I did. I lost an engine. I can't even remember what mission it was, but I think it was to Gelsenkirchen. Yeah, it was. And it was on the way in, and I lost an engine, and just barely made it back to the English coast. It takes more gas you burn a lot more gas on three engines than you do on four.
Did you ever get down to just two?
I got down to none.
Well, let's hear about it.
Let's see, that was, oh boy, you're testing me.
That's what I'm here for. Bill's only 93 years old.
That was a mission to Schweinfurt. Not Schweinfurt, Stuttgart.
Stuttgart, all right.
Now, Stuttgart is in North Germany. It's in the corner. I was trying to think. It would be east, west.
Northwest corner of Germany.
It's right along the the Swiss border.
Mm-hmm.
You follow right along the edge of the Swiss border going in. In fact, the Alps are right on your off your right wing going in.
Mm-hmm.
And flying in there, I lost. We were to bomb. In fact, it was an automobile factory that they started making aircraft engines, and we were to bomb that. And we got right to almost to the target over in the center of the city, and they put up a smoke barrage, a smoke screen, and it was so perfect, just covered the ground, you couldn't see anything. So we made one big circle and started back to pick out a secondary target, and the wind started blowing up, and you could see the target. We started back over the target again, and they started to fired it up again, so we had to make a second turn. That was a mistake, because there was many planes that didn't have the fuel for that long a mission.
So having to double back around like that, you burned all the fuel.
We had some, at that time they were starting to get the G model, and it had a it had wing tanks, or wing, extra tanks inside the wing.
Right.
So there's 60, 120 extra gallons of gas. And unfortunately, our plane didn't have one.
You weren't flying the B-17D that day.
So I started running out of gas about, well, actually, started running out of gas right over Paris. One airplane, one B-17, actually, all four run out of gas. And there was a little Japanese boy, and he bailed out, and he did a swan dive out of the waste.
Out of your plane or a different plane?
No.
There were four B-17s that ran out of gas. Is that what you said?
No, there's just one that ran almost over the Eiffel Tower.
Oh, wow.
And he did a swan dive.
Oh, man.
He told everybody he was going to do it.
And you saw it.
And I saw it.
Holy cow, that's something you don't forget.
No. And then planes started losing engines, going down into the water all the way. And I feathered one engine, transferred fuel out of one tank into the other three. Then another one went out, so I had two engines. And by the time I got I got almost to the coast, I was going to ditch in the right over the cliffs of Dover, right like the cliffs were here. I came, made a turn. I was going to.
You're going to bail out.
No, not bail out, ditches in the water.
In the water, okay.
As close as I could to land.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw, right over the cliff, I saw some fighter planes. And they started moving. And it was a New Zealand fighter plane. They were flying Typhoons, which was a clipped wing, almost like a Spitfire. It was actually faster at low altitude, and they were using those for buzz bombs. The plane would take off. They started shooting the buzz bombs down, but they lost so many of their own planes, the explosions.
They couldn't get up fast enough.
They couldn't get away, you know.
Right.
Or they couldn't get close enough when the thing exploded and it'd take their plane down too. So they flew right along with their wing underneath the tip of the buzz bomb and flip it.
Right.
And flip the gyro and they go into the ocean. And that was the technique they used for knocking down the buzz bombs.
But so you saw these New Zealand planes, and that was a good sign for you as you neared the cliffs of Dover.
Well, when we saw the, we thought at first that they were just a phony, you know, that it was just a false. But when we saw the move, well, then we came, and I was the first plane to land. And so I landed halfway down the runway, and I went through the window, through a fence, and out into a plowed field.
So when you saw those planes, you knew there's a landing strip here.
There was a landing
strip. I can take it down.
So I just took it down.
Now, and you had no communication with anybody on the ground?
No.
And now I've heard a lot of scenarios like that. Sometimes they don't know who you are. I guess maybe they recognized by then that you were friendly aircraft.
They saw there were 17.
Uh-huh. But this, you just described that landing pretty matter-of-factly, but it sounds like it was a little hairy to me. You went crashing through a fence?
Through the fence. Well, halfway down the runway, and then I went through a fence and out into the... And the plane was still there 2 weeks later. I flew over that field just to see it. It's still there.
Gave it a little wave on your way by?
Yeah.
Tipped the wing to it?
Well, now, I got to talking to the commanding officer of the... I disrupted the mission that he was about to take off for. And he gave me some 20-millimeter shells. I still have them. I should have brought them. I had two of them. I still have them. I have
some shells that they fired from those airplanes.
Yeah.
Well, that's a nice little...
I have
little...
an explosive shell, and I have an armor-piercing shell.
We won't send the authorities after you. I think we need to take our last commercial break here, but when we come back, I might talk more about that mission. Maybe one more question before we get to the commercial. You just described that whole process, and you ran out of gas over Paris, or you started realizing that you were running out of gas.
We were running low. I wasn't running out of gas. I still had four engines over Paris.
But you knew.
And I had four engines. I lost an engine just after I left the French coast over the English Channel. I had three engines.
Sounds like one of the longest trips across the channel ever. But you went from thinking you're going to ditch it in the water to seeing the cliffs of Dover and then seeing a runway and bringing it down, crashing through a fence. When you get done with that, is that one where you reach around and make sure every finger and toe and nose and ear is still there?
No, we were so glad. And these New Zealanders were so great. They gave us some wine.
And some 20-millimeter shells.
20-millimeter shells. I gave them some 50-millimeter, 50-caliber shells of mine.
A lot of smiles after that.
Yeah.
I don't know if wine and shells are the best combination in that context, but I'm glad that it worked out okay for you. We're going to take our final break, then come down the home stretch with Bill Cahow today. 93 years old, but that memory, as you can tell, is still very sharp, and he's got some more memories to share with us before we're done. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We've got another 10 minutes or so to visit with Bill Cahow. It's been quite a thrill so far. Bill is 93 years old. He drove himself to our studio today, and he still looks pretty sharp with his 381st Bomb Group hat on, that gold B-17 pin on top of it. And he served in that group, part of the 8th Air Force in Europe during World War II. And when he went in, that was when they were saying, you get over there as a bomber pilot, you fly 25 missions, and you get to come home. I imagine the closer you got to that number of 25, the more you thought, am I ever going to get to 25? Did you kind of feel some pressure or some anticipation there as that number got closer?
It seemed like you were looking at those that were ahead of you and didn't quite make it, got shot down. You're rooting for them, and you're wondering if the same thing had happened to you.
Thankfully, it didn't.
24,
mm-hmm.
It shut down on your 25th mission. The 25th mission was probably the antsiest one I had.
Why was that? Because it was number 25?
25th mission.
did it turn out to be fairly uneventful for you?
Yes, it did.
Thank the Lord. Now, I mentioned earlier about the great story that Bill McEwen wrote about Bonnie and Clyde. That's Bill and his wife Bonnie, as they're known at Perko's, their breakfast hangout. And we won't get into the origins of that nickname. But when Bill wrote his story about you and your experiences in the war for Veterans Day a couple years back, I read him describe a landing that you made that actually employed a skiing move. And you mentioned earlier you were an instructor at Badger Pass before Nick Fiore, who just passed away. And he, too, is a World War II veteran from Canada.
I was the director that turned it over to Nick when I quit.
So you went back away there, and you had plenty of skiing experience. And I read in Bill's article that you had one landing where you had to turn a perfect Christie to bring that plane to a stop. Explain to our listeners what that is, and I'm pretty sure it's not something that they teach you in flight school.
No, it's a skiing technique. It's a high-speed turn to a stop.
Mm-hmm.
And I landed crossways on the runways, out of gas, and in order to keep from running off the field, I did a Christie and just spun around.
Had you ever seen anybody do that with a B-17 before?
No.
What made you think that would work? Is it just instinctual from all that time on the slopes?
Well, I either do that or run off the field, you know. So I thought it was, I could do that, and I still had enough runway left to, I thought I could do it, so I tried it, and it worked.
What did the guys on your crew say to you after that?
Yay!
Where'd that come from?
A major came out in a Jeep, and he was raising all kind of hell for me doing something like that. And then one of my crew members told him that we just came back from a mission and we were out of gas.
Oh, he thought you were doing it for jollies, huh?
Yeah.
You're doing it for survival. It's a little different. Survival. Speaking of survival, you just talked about your 25th mission. And so at that point, you have the privilege of coming back to the States, maybe meet a pretty lady somewhere like Tampa, Florida, as you ended up doing with your wife of 63 years now, Bonnie. But on your way home, you would I understand you had turned in a plane, and then they said, well, we want you to fly this other plane back, and you're flying it toward London. But as I've heard a lot of pilots describe, sometimes the guys on the other side don't know who you are, and they're waiting for you to identify yourself because they're not sure if you're friend or foe. And you had something along those lines unfold for you there. When you think you're out of the woods, all the tough stuff is over, turned out to be one of your closest calls. What happened there?
My navigator gave me the wrong coordinates to fly towards from this repair field back to our base.
Mm-hmm.
He gave me the same coordinates as we used to get to the base. So I flew directly due north, and which was would take me right over London, and it took me over a barrage. Took me over a barrage balloon battery right in the midst of it. And the cables are just huge.
And that's where they strung those cables.
Yeah.
Basically to create a barrier for enemy airplanes.
That's right.
So those were there so people couldn't fly through them. And if they tried, their wings would just get sliced off, right?
Slice their wing off.
So you came pretty close to that.
I came within feet of the...
And what'd you have to do?
I could almost reach out and touch them.
I'm glad you
did. Grab a cable and swing around it.
Now, that would have been better than a Christie on the runway if you pulled a Tarzan on the barrage balloon cable. So you had to test that
B-7. Around the cables. Uh-huh.
That sounds pretty tricky.
Around the cables, in between the cables.
And I imagine that kind of took your breath away a little
bit.
Boy,
did it ever.
And I guess that was...
It happened so fast, you know. you're in the clear, and then you're in the cables.
You would have felt that was pretty tragic if that's what took you down flak and fighters you faced in 25 missions.
What a way to go. Stupid.
One thing you did receive was a Distinguished Flying Cross for all your work in the skies over Europe. And then you got to come home. And I understand at that point. Now, the war is over, and you're heading home. And you were headed towards where? Florida?
Florida.
Uh-huh. But you're quite a ways away, and you got in some confusion with the radio tower there in Florida. Explain that one to me. You were waiting for some celebration or to see.
No, that was at the end of the war. The war had ended.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing a 1,800 mile plane ride in a B-29.
Okay.
And we were over Texas, the Texas oil fields, when the war ended, and they called me back. But there was a skip, a radio skip, and I could receive the tower just like I was 20 miles away.
The tower from Florida, you were picking up in Texas.
I was receiving that just crystal clear because of this radio skip. And they didn't believe me. They asked me where I was, and I told them I was over Corpus Christi or somewhere over Texas. And they told me, well, you're next to land.
You're next to land.
The next to land, get that plane down, the war is over. Go to the officers' club and celebrate. So it took me 3 hours or more to get back. By the time I got back, the officers' club was trashed. Everybody was drunk and gone home. And I got there, got down, and there was no booze left. I was devastated.
And they were probably waiting for you for quite a while.
What a way to win a war.
Well, I imagine, and you just mentioned kind of on the side there that you had been called back up. That was a B-29. You were flying. Had the war not ended, had the bombs not been dropped, I guess you probably would have ended up flying some missions in the Pacific.
Probably so.
Well, I'm glad that you didn't have to do that, and I'm glad that you've been able to share some of those stories with us today.
I was an instructor pilot in B-29s, operations officer at MacDill Field. And one of my pilots flew a co-pilot in the Hiroshima bombing mission.
Who was that?
Bill Town? No. Bill, what was Bill's last name?
Not Bill Town.
I'll have to look that one up for you. So of the Hiroshima bombing, the co-pilot, was one of your students as you trained after your 25 missions were done. You continued training him. Well, certainly another connection.
In fact, he was the day I picked Bonnie up off the streets.
I don't know if she'd tell me the same version of that story. But
in a hurricane.
He's getting himself in trouble now. Thankfully, we're just about out of time on the show, so I will preserve your wedded bliss and not get you in any more trouble, Bill. I will give you one more chance. We've got about a minute left. If there's anything that you want to share with our listeners that didn't live through World War II the way you did, that didn't see the things that you saw, if there's one thing you want them to remember about what you and more than 16 million other Americans did in serving their country at that time, what's that one thing you think is important to live on and for people to remember?
Just don't get into another world war.
Pretty simple, but pretty powerful. Absolutely. Well, Bill, thank you very much for your service to our country, and thank you for sharing some of those stories with us today. And I'm sure you'll thank me later for keeping you out of trouble with your lovely wife, Bonnie. That's Bill Cahow, our guest today. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.